Good morning. So last time we finished up our discussion of exceptions by going into how I/O works with exceptions. We like kind of wrote down there's exceptions for I/O. What does that actually mean? And we said, well, sometimes devices need to tell the OS that they need attention, that they have data that's ready for the OS to read, or that some request the OS made earlier is now fulfilled, and often something that's not actually dealing with that device will be active on the processor, and we need to switch to the OS to have the device be handled. And that's what the I/O exceptions are for. And this means that we have this pattern with I/O where we can kind of have these kind of two scenarios. So one is that a program requests to do some import or output, and the data is available right away. So for output, the device can accept that output right away, in which case the program makes a system call, the output gets sent, and that's it. There's no need for another exception because the device doesn't need attention later. Or for input, maybe the device has had the input already ready or notified the OS earlier about the input. Then there's no for attention. But often we have a scenario where we request to send output or get input, and not all of our output or input can be received or sent right away. In which case, typically what operating systems will do is that they'll queue as much as they can and do something else in the meanwhile and arrange to be notified through an exception when the device is ready to continue. And this exception is pretty likely to occur in the middle of a program that has nothing to do with that device. If I request to send something on the Wi-Fi and the Wi-Fi card can't send it right away, well, it's going to tell the OS sometime later when some other program is probably running, hey OS, that thing you wanted to send, you can do it now. And then the OS will finish that process. Then we talked a bit about signals and signal handlers. So we mentioned that signals are kind of like a version of exceptions for processes and threads, in the sense that exceptions were something for the OS and processors. You can register a handler for certain events. So exceptions for the OS is how the OS handles events like programs requesting things or devices needing attention or timers going off and so on. With signals, you can register a handler for events that are things that might be events in your program or events external to your program that the OS is willing to notify you about. And your handler will run in the middle of your process. So your process is running normally, and the OS will call your handler, stopping whatever your process is doing and having it run that handler. And we looked at some examples of the code, and when we were finishing up last time, we got into this issue, which is really complicates things with using signals, and means that what seems like a nice, useful mechanism probably isn't a thing you want to use very often, is that signal delivery can occur at weird times, and most code is not really written to handle that. And it's really not intuitive to make a signal handler that is safe. And we'll finish up that discussion today and move on to talking a bit more about processes more generally. So before I do that, questions about these things we covered last time? Okay. One brief logistical thing. So we have some anonymous feedback saying that it seems some people think collaboration's allowed on the quizzes. It's not. So if you're sharing answers for the quizzes before the deadline, that is not allowed. I don't think I wasn't clear on that, but it doesn't hurt to say that. So going back to this signal delivery at weird times issue. So we have this example here where we have a malloc implementation. This is one way you could implement malloc, where it probably has some big region of memory. It has a next to return pointer. And the way malloc works is that, it finds some space here and then advances the next to return pointer to point to the end of it and returns that chunk of memory. So that's one way we could implement malloc. And so we have this code to do that, where we identify we want to return where next to return used to point, and we increment next to return by size for the next call to malloc. A pretty simple, relatively realistic way that you might implement malloc. Real implementations of malloc probably do a bunch more complicated things for performance and other considerations that we won't get into. But this is pretty realistic. And we have this scenario where we called malloc and we got real lucky. And our user pressed control C just about here. Or at least the signal was delivered, as in our signal handler ran just there. And our signal handler calls printf, and printf is allowed to allocate memory. It might want to do so to hold temporary data because it, in general, can handle formatting strings and numbers. It probably wants space for that. So we might imagine that printf tries to call malloc while the state of the next to return pointer is kind of broken. And so then we end up with this scenario where we've kind of decided our first call to malloc, so we have our buffer here, should return this chunk of memory. And then we have a second call of malloc, and because this next to return pointer still points to that first point of memory, we haven't run the next line of code, we're going to return our allocation for malloc is going to be overlapping. And then when everything finishes up, we're going to advance next to return to point to here for the printf allocation and then to here for the original allocation. And this is almost certainly going to break something somewhere. If not now, maybe sometime much later after we call free on one of these chunks of memory. So questions about our scenario and why it's going to be a problem? Yeah?
So the issue with that, when you malloc the first time, you set the return address, and the second time,
The issue is that when we malloc the first time, we set the return address, and the second time it's using the same return address as before, and yes. And that's only because we could call malloc in the middle of malloc. And it's really hard to write functions which can be called in the middle of themselves if they have any state. This is known as a reentrant function. You'll sometimes see man pages say whether a function's reentrant. And it's really hard to write reentrant functions if they have any sort of state. And this is an example of a malloc, which isn't that way. Yeah. So normally, you wouldn't be concerned about this, because normally you can't call things in the middle of malloc. But here we can. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? So we have this scenario. So you might say, how can we avoid this problem, right? We have this signal handler mechanism. How can we use it and not have our program crash some small percentage of the time, but in some impossible to debug way? And the solution that the people who standardized Unix, POSIX, came up with is that they have a list of async signal safe functions. And on Portal, you can type man signal safety and we'll get you the official list. And these are functions which are required to work correctly even when they're called within themselves potentially in a signal handler. It's not specified how that's done, it's up to the implementation. There's varying strategies. We'll look at one potential idea in a bit. This list is, it's not short, but it doesn't include a lot of things you might want it to include. So for example, printf, not on the list. Malloc, not on the list. Exit, not on the list. And this is just a list of ones where it's guaranteed that the people implementing the Linux standard library have gone through the effort of making sure that they behave correctly, even when they're called within themselves. And so this is why some of the examples we had earlier that used printed things in our signal handler used write instead of printf, and used underscore exit instead of exit, is because it avoids these concerns. Questions on async signal safety list? Yeah.
What makes those functions async signal safe?
What makes those functions async signal safe? They just basically, there's just a promise that they're implemented such that they don't have state like that to return value. Or if they do, they're manipulating when signals can be delivered to prevent that from being a problem. Probably in most cases, the functions correspond to a single system call, and you can't like have a signal delivered in a bad way in the middle of a system call because the OS, which handles the system call, is also handling signal delivery. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? So, because this signal safety is such a big issue, we like to go over an alternate way and what I would typically recommend for handling signals when practical. And this is not to use signal handlers, but to take advantage of blocking signals and some interfaces related to that. So we'll talk about first about blocking signals, which are a way we could make things signal safe. And also will be a tool we can use to handle signals without having a signal handler. And what blocking signals does is it makes the signal handler not run. So instead of running, the signal handler becomes, so the signal becomes pending and doesn't get delivered until it is unblocked. You might also see this called masking a signal because the list of blocked signals is known as the signal mask. List of blocked signals equals mask. And that explains what that sig mask argument to the sig action function was. It was setting the list of blocked signals when the signal handler ran. And so kind of the way we can kind of think of this working in our simple case is that we block a signal and before we would receive it, and when the signal is received by us, instead of our signal handler running or our process crashing, the OS just says, okay, now it's also pending. And if we just unblock the signal sometime later, while it's still pending, well, the pending signal will then get delivered, meaning that it will run our signal handler or crash our program or whatever the signal normally does. And so this would be one strategy we could use as a kind of brute force thing to make async signal safe functions. We just block all the signals, do our work, unblock them. It's not a very efficient strategy, but it would work. So, Another thing we can do with blocked impending signals is that they're functions to sort of either unblock signals in a very controlled manner or to look at the set of pending signals. So an idea we could have is that instead of having our signal handlers run at sort of most times, we could say that we're going to have the signal usually be blocked. We aren't just going to block it for dangerous functions, we're just going to block it most of the time. And when we want the signal to be handled, we'll call some special function like sigsuspend, which will unblock the signal and wait for the handler for it to run. Or like pselect, which will unblock the signal while checking for IO and then reblock it immediately afterwards. But these will, you know, unblock the signal only for a sort of controlled period of time and then reblock it. Or alternately, we can block the signal, and then there are API functions which, instead of handling the signal with a signal handler, we just look at the list of pending signals and we say, okay, I see that's pending, make it not pending anymore. And this, there's a call sigwait which does this. It waits for a blocked signal to be pending, and once it becomes pending, it just marks it not pending and returns that, hey, I did this to you. And we can use this instead of having a signal handler. And kind of the way that sigwait would work, you know, is that kind of there's two cases. We could block the signal, and then when the signal's received, if we haven't called sigwait yet, well, the way blocking a signal work is signals become pending. And then we call sigwait, and it says, oh, that signal's pending. It marks it not pending, tells you it did that. And sometimes, and we can, you know, figure out that that happened and do whatever we like with this about, you know, getting the signal, like, oh, best control C was pressed. I'm going to deal with that. Or alternately, you know, maybe it's the case that we block the signal, we call sigwait, and then we receive the signal. In that case, the signal like briefly becomes pending, sigwait realizes, oh, it's pending, it marks it not pending for you, and tells you you did that, and you say, okay, now I can handle that. So we have these kind of two options for handling signals by having them usually be blocked and, you know, either not running signal handlers at all or only running signal handlers at very controlled times by unblocking for brief periods of time. Questions about this, what I would say is synchronous signal handling. It's synchronous because we are deciding when signals are handling in our normal code rather than it happening asynchronously separate from our code, not synchronized with it. Okay. And I have our code example here. So here I make a call to sigprocmask to block sigint. And then I print waiting for control C, and then I call sigwait. And sigwait will tell me through num what signal it actually made not pending. And as we saw with these timelines here, if control C is received like here, then sigwait will return right away. If control C is not received until after sigwait starts, that's also fine. Sigwait will wait until the sigint gets triggered by control C. Questions? Yeah. Does sigwait stop the program until the signal is pending? Yes. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah. So I guess if you want to just check if a signal is pending without waiting, there are functions to do that. They're just not something I'm checking. Other questions? Okay, so that's our coverage of signals. And I'll just mention, we have a lab next week where you're going to make a kind of inter-process chat program. So the idea is there's two instances of the program running on, say, a portal server. And we will give you code to set up shared memory between those two programs, meaning that we'll have it such that you can actually access the same bytes of memory from the two different programs using just a pointer. But you know, that's a good way to send messages, but it's not an easy way for you to have one program notify the other that a message is available, and you're going to use signals to have one program notify the other a message is available to receive. That's our preview of that lab. And in the lab, we have you use signal handlers to do that. Because that's the simplest way, even though, as I said, you know, in real programs, I try pretty hard to avoid writing signal handlers personally, or to only write them and have them run at very specific times, or maybe in a separate thread. We haven't talked about multi-threaded programming, but that's another third option we didn't explore. Other questions? Okay. So, next topic, since we talked about signals, is going to be process management. And we're going to look at the process management functions that are part of POSIX, which is the standard that Linux follows. And we're not going to look at all of them, but we're going to look at kind of the essential ones. For how we kind of create, wait for, manipulate processes. So these are like the things that your shell does. You know, you type a command like ls, what calls is the shell making to make that happen? How can you do that yourself? We're going to talk about that process. And I have had a partial list of operations. So we mentioned we have PIDs. We saw this with signals, so there's a call to get your current PID, which is get PID. And the PID, as we mentioned, saw, was a number, which is a unique number for each process. And we need a way to start new processes. And you might see something confusing here, that I have process creation is separate from running a program. You might say, gosh, if I type ls, isn't that just process creation / running a program, is that the one thing I'm doing? And, well, that would be a reasonable idea, but Unix and POSIX separate that into kind of two steps. We create a process, but it's going to be running the same program we're already running. And then we make that process run a different program. So we have these separate operations of creating a process and changing what program a process is running. And we'll talk about how those operations work, because you know they're kind of non-intuitive, and also kind of the implications of when things run is non-intuitive. And it's something we're going to want to reason about also when we talk about multiple threads. Now, once we've created a process, another thing we want to do is we want to wait for the process to finish. So if you think of your shell, you say, oh, I type ls, and the shell isn't doing anything until ls finishes. That doesn't happen for free. That normally, when we have two processes running, they just both run. We talked about time multiplexing, that the ls switches to give you the illusion that each process is kind of always running, even though they're taking turns. Well, that's what's going to happen automatically. So if I just start ls and don't do anything, I'm going to keep running before LS finishes, you know, and that's not going to be good for my shell. I'm going to output my prompt while LS is outputting its directory information. It's going to be very confusing. So we have ways of waiting for processes to finish. And this is also how we're going to figure things out, like, did the process crash? Did the process finish successfully? And we also have, of course, to have a way to have our process exit. You've probably seen exit before. We're going to talk about how it interacts with waiting for processes and so on. And you just saw kill, which is for sending a signal. But as its name suggests, if we send the correct signal, we can use it to forcibly, basically, cause another process to exit, which is probably how it got its name. And why it's not named send signal, which would be the better name. So let's look at fork, which is probably the most confusing function we will cover in this class. We're going to spend a bunch of time. So fork, this is the prototype that's declared in the header. It takes no arguments and returns a PID. And it copies the current process. So that means, because the current process includes our program counter and all our memory, that it's going to return twice. It's going to have one return in the original process, one return in the copy. And it's convenient if we can figure out if we're in the original or the copy. So to help us with that, fork's return value is going to be different depending on whether you're in the original or the copy. In the original process, which will be called the parent process, it will return the PID of the new process. And you kind of need this because there's not a good way of getting that process ID otherwise. In the child process, it will tell you you're in the child by returning 0. If you want to get the PID of the child process in the child process, well, you can call getPID. And basically, other than the return values being different and the PIDs being different, everything else is duplicated. So, kind of give an idea of what's going on. And I have this without copy and write. This is the simple version. We'll talk about the more complex version when we talk about virtual memory later. The simple version, relatively simple, of how you might implement this is that, well, we're the OS. We're going to track information about the process. So our information includes all its registers, includes its page tables, which we'll learn is the sort of memory mapping, so it's the address translation. And so this is our allocated memory. And our open files, and probably a bunch of other information. Signal handlers that are set up, and so on. And fork is just going to make a copy of this, everything, and it's going to be a deep copy. So all that memory mapping information that tells us what memory we have allocated, we're going to copy all of that. And then we're going to make some small changes. We're going to fill in the return value differently in the two processes, and we're going to have a different PID for the child. And after we do this, now we have two processes available to switch to whenever the processor is free. So when we're deciding to have take turns between different processes in the processor, now there are, you know, is an extra possibility for us to switch to, and at some point we will run the child process, and at some point we will keep running the parent process. And it's pretty much arbitrary which the OS does when, especially if we have multiple cores. So once we've created this copy, you know, it's going to run at some point. So, I'm going to show a little example here of using fork. And you can see here that we have a bunch of times where we're getting our current process ID, because when we make our copy, we're going to have a new process ID. So that's kind of interesting information to know. So I get my original process ID, then I call fork, and I check my process ID in both. And I also do some error checking here. So you see I'm calling fork, I'm checking if the return value is greater than 0, as we saw here, that would be if it's the PID of a child process. And then I'm checking if it's 0. That would be if we're in the child process. And this else case, it's going to be -1, I guess I should say. It's going to be a PID, -1 converted to a PID. Then it failed. Why would it fail? Well, this copying process requires space and memory, and we could be out of space. And with the kind of simple version we have here, it requires a lot of space, potentially. So I'll start with this error handling here. I'm printing this perfor function prints fork failed : and then the last error that occurred. So an example error we might get is resource temporarily unavailable. In POSIX, errors are the last error stored in the global variable error node. So let's go through what an example successful execution would look like. And I'm going to kind of draw diagrams to show what's going on with threads like this. I have this squiggly line going down, indicating a thread is running. I indicate the call to fork, and this creates a new thread, while the current thread also continues. And these execute at the same time conceptually. They might really be taking turns, but that's kind of, you know, invisible. And we don't know the relative order things in them will happen because they're executing at the same time and potentially at different speeds. So what will happen is before the fork, we will print out parent PID as something. Then the fork will happen. And then in some order, the parent will print out this parent of message. And the child will print out this child message. So I give one possible output here. Our parent PID is 100. And then we print out our PID, which is still 100 in the parent, is the parent of 432, which is the PID we got from fork. In the child, when it calls get PID, it gets 432, and it prints out child. And it happened in this case that the parent ran its printf before the child did. It could easily have happened that these happened in the opposite order. It just depends on sort of when the OS has a chance to run each program and what else it wants to run on the system. So questions? Yes?
So the fork
method right there wouldn't just infinitely create, or wouldn't infinitely create new processes in the child when it's run?
Question, would infinitely create new processes in the child when it's run? So no, because the first instruction the child runs is returning from fork. So when we copy the process, we're copying the process in the middle of the call to fork. We're not starting it from the beginning, we're starting it from that middle of that call with all the variables, all the memory set the same way. And this is kind of a, you know, part of why, you know, this is copying all the registers, right? All the registers, which is going to include our program counter, were copied. Does that answer your question? But yes, that's a common point of confusion. We're, you know, when we're copying the process state includes exactly where we are in our call stack and all that. Other questions? Is this also how it works on multi-core CPUs? Yes. So there's nothing about this process which changes on multi-core. The only, like, you know, practical difference might be that, you know, what ordering gets chosen is probably, you know, more variable.
And the child process can be created on a different core?
The child process can be created on a different core? I would say the child process might run first on a different core. Or it might not. It's up to how the OS decides to distribute cores between programs, which is a very variable decision. Okay. Other questions? Follow-ups? Okay, so as I mentioned, this is probably the most confusing function we'll look at, and it's, the big reason it's confusing is because of this returning twice thing, and the second biggest reason is that's combined with, we have two things running at the same time, and as we'll see, that's kind of hard to reason about. Well, maybe not, we won't see today, but we'll see eventually. So let's do a little exercise now that we've seen fork. So here I have a call to fork, and remember that fork. So in the parent, the original, it returns the child PID. And in the child, it returns the returns zero. And I'd like to have now two possible outputs. Of this code. And check with your neighbor, see if you agree on what should happen. Who'd like some more time? Who can give me one possibility? One possible output. Yeah.
If it is the child, it would just print out in child, skipping the else statement and then printing them at the end.
Okay, so you're, I want the output of both of them combined, but that's a good start. So the child will print out in child and then done, yeah. So what would be the combined output? Or do you want me to go? Yeah.
Wouldn't it be like child and then 100?
Okay.
In that case?
So child 100.
And then would the child like process go through it? That's when the in child is printed.
Okay.
And then at that point done.
And that's it?
I believe so. I could be wrong.
Okay, so there's a, so someone want to have a, another done, yes. So this is a subtlety that is deliberately part of this question, because a lot of people quite sensibly say, oh, we have this if statement that decides what code executes in the child. So they say, oh, okay, so that means that we're going to just execute, you know, this code in the child, and that's it. And that's not how it works. When we finish this if statement in the child, we're going to go on to here. When we finish this if statement in the parent, we're going to go on to here. So done gets printed out twice, no matter what execution we have. And this is part of this exercise because it's very easy to, you know, just say, oh, this is the child code, and forget that it keeps going. Yeah. So it's, you know, here, because this is a common error that's super easy to make. So that is one possible output. Someone give me another one? Yeah. Okay, so you say we could flip these two. Okay. Anyone give me a third? Yeah. So we could also have child 100 done. We could have the child, we could have the parent execute kind of entirely before the child does. Yep. Because once we fork, it's kind of up to the OS, and probably also up to what other things does the OS have to run in the processors, what order the child and parent actually end up executing in. And even with a single core, right, the OS gets to decide how often does it switch between the two to like give the illusion that they're both running at the same time, and that's going to change potentially, you know, what outputs we get. Questions? Yes. Question: with the fork fail, would it just print done twice? It would print done once, because if fork fails, no copy is made. Or rather, if fork like tries to start making a copy and fails, it will tear down the copy and return. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Okay. Okay, so let's do another exercise to get at kind of the other thing that's, so we talked about, you know, the issue with, you know, the if statement not constraining execution and the things run at the same time so the ordering can vary. Another issue that comes up is thinking about how fork interacts with bellies. So my question here is, which of these are possible outputs? And I'll give you some time to think about it.
So
And the key thing here to remember is that fork copies everything, and it's what we saw was a deep copy. Would like some more time? Got a few people. And you can check your answers with your neighbors if you like. Okay, let's do, who thinks A is possible? Who thinks B is possible? C is possible? D is possible? E? F? No clue. Okay, so we have a big split. So, let's think about where X and Y are probably stored. And if we go back to my diagram here, X is a global variable. Global variables are going to be stored in the memory. So the original version of X was probably, I should use probably different, probably this is where X is. It's in that memory, and it was copied. So that means the parent and child now have different versions of X and Y once fork finishes. And that means any changes to X in one of the processes won't change it in the other anymore. Then we have Y. So there's kind of two places that Y could be stored. So the most intuitive possibility, if we think of writing, you know, nice assembly, is that would be in a register. And if it's in a register, like here, well, that got copied. So we now have two independent versions of Y after the fork. Alternately, it might be on the stack. That's another part of this memory that got copied. So those would also be independent. And so this means that our possible answers are actually A and D. But it's very, and I'm pointing this out very explicitly because you know, it's easy to miss this implication of what we mean by, like, this is a deep copy. That after the fork, the processes are really independent of each other. Like, you know, kind of, you know, yeah. So, question.
Can you walk through how you get the outcome of
D? How do I get the outcome of D? So, for D, so what would happen? So let me do my general diagram, which is also kind of a way you can figure out all the possibilities. So beforehand, we have x equals 0, and y does not exist, right? Okay. Then we call fork. Immediately after the fork, we have an independent x equals 0, and also y does not exist in both processes. Then, in, let's say this is our child here. In our child, we're going to run this code, and we're going to set x equal 1. First we're going to set y equals 0. So we're going to end up having x equals 0, y equals 0. And then we're going to set x plus equals 1, so we're going to have x, y equals 1, 0, and then we're going to set y plus equals 2, so we're going to have x, y equals 1, 2, and then we're going to print. In the parent, we're going to run this code, so we're going to, so first we're going to have x, y equals 0, then x, y equals 3, 0, when we see x plus equals 3, and x, y equals 3, 4, and then we're going to print. And what happens in the parent and child, because we have independent copies of x and y, you know, this is always what happens if we just think of each of them independently. We don't need to think about when does the parent execute relative to the child for determining the values of x and y. Now, what we do need to worry about is, when do these two prints run? And that depends on when the operating system decides to run the parent and child. And we don't know that, and that will in fact vary in practice, because there's probably other things the operating system's trying to do, and we don't know how it decides which is more important to run, the parent or the child. And so that means those prints could happen in either order. And those two orders are how we get A and D together. So it's just depending whether the parent's print runs first or the child's print runs first. Does that answer your question?
Yes, yeah, so if the local variable Y wasn't like set to 0 in the child, then when the child process got those copies first, would it like add on top of the parent process?
So question, if the local variable Y wasn't set in the main body. So what? Where would it be set then?
So if y was equal to like 2.
Okay.
Then,
like 2 here?
And then, I get what you're saying. So it doesn't really matter. Like, it doesn't add on to top of the parent process ever.
Yeah, it doesn't add on top of the parent process ever, but yeah, because they're independent copies.
Okay.
So it's kind of like, you know, after the fork, it's kind of like you just started two separate programs. Yeah. Yes?
To 100% clarify, there's never any example of when there would be the case that making a fork would make it like that kind of shallow copy where both reference kind of the same address.
It's a question. There's never going to be a case where we're going to have a shallow copy.
Not shallow copy, just like
we're going to have shared data. If you want to make that the case, you have to specifically arrange it. So for example, I mentioned in the signals lab, we're going to deliberately set up shared memory between two separately started processes. That same mechanism you can use to share memory between the parent and the child. But you're not going to do it by accident. You're going to explicitly be making a call, special call to make shared memory. Does that answer your question? And back there. So the question is, if I have a pointer, since we're doing copying the memory, does the pointer still have the same value? And the answer is yes, because remember we have this address translation. So what we're doing a deep copy including the mapping. So your pointers go through this mapping to the real memory address. So you're using virtual or fake memory addresses. We'll talk about how those work later. And those virtual addresses won't change. And the copy will basically set up the mapping so it uses the same virtual addresses, even though they now go to different real addresses. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Yeah. Question, if I set a variable after a fork, would it create two different ones in the parent and child? If I create a variable, yeah, there will be two different variables. Or if I had a variable created before the fork, there will now be two after the fork. Yeah. Other questions? Looked like you had something. Nope, okay. Okay. Yes, and so, yeah, and I went through this. This is, you know, a big point of confusion, which is why I have this exercise here. The big thing to remember is that, like, after the fork, they're really independent of each other, just like as if they were started separately. Okay, so we've talked about creating processes, and in doing so, we've talked about doing it in a way which doesn't seem super useful. Usually when I think of starting a process, I have like some program I want to run. How do we run some program? And that's a separate operation where the library calls for that start with exec. I have the star because there's a bunch of variants of them, which just differ in how they take their arguments. I'll look at the specific variant of exec v. And so execv takes the path, the file that the new program is contained in, and the value to give it as argv. And to know how long argv is, and therefore set argc, argv needs to be an array terminated with a null pointer. And there's a bunch of other variants, but they just differ in how you pass argv and things like that. So to give an example of how that works, let's think about what our shell should do when I type ls minus l. And this is the sort of code it might be running. That it creates a new process with fork, but that new process isn't running ls, and we want to run ls. So what it can do is in that process, it sets up an argv for ls, and if I type ls minus l, we expect argv of 0 in ls to be ls, and argv of 1 to be minus l. And then I have a null terminator, so execv will know I expect I'm passing two arguments, the program name and that first minus l argument. And then we call execv. We say the program we want to run is located in slash bin ls, and argv are the arguments we want it to get when it runs main. And execv's normal operation is to switch to that new program and never switch back. So that means when things work, this is where the execution of this code ends, and it goes to executing ls. So I have code here, which is just to handle if exec fails for some reason, like maybe we're out of memory, maybe it's not actually in bin ls, it's in somewhere else. That's all that code is there for. It won't be reached when exec works. Yes. Why is ls? Sorry?
Why is it an R?
So, when we write a program in C and take arguments, we take argc and char star star argv. And normally, argv of 0 is the name your program was given on the command line. And argv of 1 is our first kind of real argument. And we're following that convention because that's what most programs expect. So the question was, why is ls the first argument? That's why. Yeah. Answer your question? Okay. Other questions? So let's think of what happens when, you know, as far as what our operating system is doing. So we have our page tables, that is our memory mapping, and our registers. And what exec is going to do is we're going to set up a completely new set of memory and memory mappings for the new thing we want to run. And we're going to copy the arguments into that new set of memory. And we're also going to replace all our registers with starting values. And then we're going to discard the old memory of the original process. So we're using the same process, but we're making the process now have the memory for just starting ls, and the registers for just starting ls, instead of whatever was in there before. But it will have some of the same information. So one example is it has the same files open. And this is kind of important because, you know, when you run a program, you want it to output to the same terminal you ran it from. Questions? Process. And note that because we're replacing the process and discarding the old memory, we can't go back. And because we couldn't go back, that's, you know, kind of why we had to, you know, for our typical case, we often use this with fork, that the original process we're not execing in, so it keeps running the same program, the child doesn't. Yeah, and can never, you know, is not going to have a chance to go back to the original program. We've discarded all of that data. It's not going to be there anymore. Questions about exec? Yes? Of course, is the page table not changed? So in this example, I'm assuming that we just edit the mapping to point to different data. We could potentially make a new one. It's kind of a wash whether one way is better or not. Does that answer your question? What's not changed, sorry, is the open files. And there's possibly other information that's not changed in the process. Actually, we know of some, for example, like UID. Not changed, typically not changed. So, does that answer your question? Yeah. Question, how does the new process know what directory it's in? So that's another thing that's not changed. So we have some things that are not changed here. So this includes not changed includes open files, current directory, the signals masked, I believe. And there's a bunch of other things that aren't changed by exec. Does that answer your question? Okay. So this shows our typical pattern for running a program. And you might say, if I'm going to make a copy of the current process, then load a new process into memory and discard that copy, except for the process control, except for like that basic information, registers, files, you know. Why am I bothering doing this? Couldn't we just have a single function that does a new process loading a different program from the beginning steps? Why don't we have that API? And it is a real interface that some OSs have. For example, the Windows API has a function called createProcess, which is basically makes a new process that's running a different program from the beginning. And POSIX has a rarely used function for this called POSIXSpawn that implements the same kind of API. So why did the Unix designers choose this fork plus exec idea when it's always been that kind of the most common thing we're doing is not trying to kind of run two copies of the current program at once, but run a different program? And I think probably the big reason for it is that this prevented them from needing to have a much more complicated API for like this create process idea. So if you look at the Windows create process function, it has a lot of arguments because you need to be able to specify things like, what if I want to start this process in a different directory or, you know, with different open files? You need to be able to specify all that information. And with the fork idea, if you want to change that sort of thing, you just change it by having the child process use the normal functions to like change to a different directory or close or open files. So that's probably the reason they did it. Also, the performance of copying everything is not as bad as it sounds, because there's this neat trick called copy on write we'll talk about later that makes it not as bad for copying. So I think they had reasonable reasons for doing it, but you know, it's not crazy to think maybe we should have this simpler API where we don't separate these two operations. And to give an example, like I'll call the POSIX spawn. Here's POSIX spawn doing that fork plus exec idea, but in one call. So we say we want to run bin ls. I set my argv. And I also have these other arguments I need because, you know, we need some way of like saying I want different files open. I want other things to change. So in that sense, it's a more complicated interface to provide. But there's some who say, so, and this is a paper from 2019's Hot OS workshop, so Hot Topics and Operating Systems workshop, which it's a place where you can write a research paper that's also a rant. And here's one of them. And they're saying here, you know, in this paper, we argue that fork was a clever hack for machines and programs of the 1970s that has long outlived its usefulness and is now a liability. We catalog the ways in which fork is a terrible abstraction for the modern programmer to use, and describe how it compromises OS implementations, propose alternatives. So there's maybe reason, good reason to believe that maybe if we were making a new OS design and weren't concerned about like the history of Linux and Unix, we wouldn't use fork anymore. But that, you know, Unix systems dating back to the 70s had this fork API, so a lot of programs want to have it and expect it. So questions about our alternatives to fork plus exec? Okay. So we talked about fork and exec, so creating a new process and having that new having a process run a different program, which were separate operations, but often we will combine, because often when we want to run a new program, we want to have the current program keep running. How do we do that? We run the new program in a new process. Now, something else we often want to do when we run a new program is we want to wait for that program to finish, or even if we don't wait for it to finish, we want to figure out if it finished. And the mechanism for doing that is wait PID, the one we'll talk about. And here's the API for wait PID. It takes a PID to wait for. It takes a pointer to a status. So this is one example we mentioned at the beginning of the semester. We're going to see lots of functions where they really want to return multiple values, but they can't. So they're returning one of the values by you pass in a pointer, and then you fill in the thing that pointer points to. This is an example of that. So wait PID really wants to return the PID it waited for and the status, but it can't return that as its return value. So the status is returned by setting the pointer you pass it. So we pass in a PID, a place to put the status, and some options. You can read the manual page to see what the options are. We'll, in our examples, be passing 0. But I guess probably the most notable option is that if you want to check if the process is terminated without waiting, there's an option for that. And we'll typically pass in an explicit PID, but you can pass in a PID of -1 to indicate wait for any child process, in which case, that's why you'll use the return value to know which one was actually waited for. So as for how you might use this, you know, you call fork, and in your parent process, you can wait for the child to finish with a call to wait PID. And the child, when it exits, this wait PID call will return, and the status will tell you about how it exited. So something I'd like to note about this that's kind of subtle is I said wait for a child process. So you can only wait PID for a child process. It has to be a process that your process worked. Even if you know the PID of other processes, can't use wait PID to wait for them. Questions on kind of basic usage of wait PID. So then let's talk about, we have this status variable, what's it going to get filled in with? And probably what you'd say intuitively is that, oh, well, we can pass a status when we exit. So, like, we return 0 from main, where does that 0 go? Or you call exit 0, where does that 0 go? That is an exit status. And this is not quite, it's related to what that, the status wait PID returns is, but it's not quite the same thing. So wait PID status encodes both that exit status and information to indicate if maybe the process didn't exit. Maybe it crashed. Maybe it segfaulted. And there are these macros with start with a W where you can decode that value to extract what was passed to XSet, or did it crash from like segfault or segcherm? It will tell you that prediction. So this is where we'll finish up today. So next time we'll talk about what the typical combination of fork, exec, and wait looks like, and how that executes overall.